The Simba Room Effect from RPGGods.org and FictionSuit.org.
Hi and welcome to the programme. I'm Dave.
And I'm Matthew.
And today's programme is covering a Simba Room special which will feature the rest of the interview we had with the Jan Ringen guys, Matthias Lilja and Martin Grip, when we saw them in Stockholm last week.
What about Henrik?
Henrik.
I ought to explain.
We ought to explain, yeah.
Henrik was a guy we met on the street. Martin came to our appointed rendezvous point and introduced himself and shook hands. And then this other guy came along and shook hands with all three of us and introduced himself as Henrik. And we all kind of stood around a bit because we didn't know who he was.
He did come over when we said, oh, hello, Martin.
He did.
Came over and went, oh, yeah. Martin.
So we assumed he was another person from Jan Ringen or somebody like that who's going to join us. But then Martin had, I have to say, the gumption to say, so what's the deal here?
And well, he looked at us a bit weirdly, and we looked at him a bit weirdly, as if we were each saying to each other without saying it, who the hell is this guy?
Yeah.
only for it to transpire that Henrik, if that was his name, I think
was
waiting
was,
in the exact same spot that we were waiting for another person called Martin.
Yes.
So when he heard Martin, he was like, ha ha, that must be the person I was supposed to see.
Much embarrassment all round, but luckily most of it on his side, I hope.
Interesting start to our meeting with Martin, and then Matthias turned up a little bit after that.
Yes, yeah. So Matthias got things on the ball, and they bought us lunch. We did so well for getting food bought for us in Sweden, didn't we?
We did. They bought us lunch, and then we found a very nice cafe to talk to them about lots of stuff, but obviously Simba Room being a key thing with that. Just for reference to you all, the cafe got busier and busier for the hour that we were there, so the noise levels will get a bit noisier because it obviously was a public place. But I think everything is still fine. Matt's done an excellent job in trying to get the sound levels to the point so it doesn't actually spoil the enjoyment of the interview any, I don't think.
I don't think so. I think it's a really excellent job of noise reduction, if I say so myself.
That's your real skill, isn't it? That's the one thing you're really good at.
It's one of the many things I'm really good at.
It's one thing. You just don't do it often enough, especially when you're being irritating and loud. The other thing that came up last week is Matthew had a horrible cold, which
I knew
now
you were gonna bring
I have. So if I sniffle or cough a little bit, I'm going to rely upon Matthew's skills to noise reduce that out when we come to editing this.
Yeah, and I have to say, I'm still recovering from said cold, so I might still sniffle or cough, although hopefully not as much as you, Dave.
Anyway, that's probably enough about your and my health, Matthew. Let's move on to the interview with Matthias and Martin.
Yes, let's. Now, in episode 12 of The Coriolis Effect, we played a bit of that interview, including the two of them introducing themselves. I guess we're going to play that again so everybody gets to know who they are and attaches their voice to their name. But we're actually going to start off at the beginning of the interview this time, aren't we?
Yes, that's right. And what we won't do is replay the Coriolis element of the interview, because this podcast is all about Simba Room and Jan Ringen. If you want to hear and you haven't already heard the Coriolis elements, go back to episode 12 of The Coriolis Effect, and you can hear it all there.
So this bit of the interview is going to be Martin and Matthias talking about their early days in gaming.
Hi, and welcome to day two of mine and Matthew's Stockholm Swedish adventure. And today is a gloriously sunny day here in Gamla Stan in Stockholm. And even more glorious because we are sat in a nice cafe with two of the people from Jan Ringen, which I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that just about right.
Really good.
We have Matthias Lilja, welcome.
Thank you.
And Martin Grip. Yeah. Welcome. Hello. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you very much indeed for finding the time to talk to us.
No problem. really excited to meet you guys. As everybody will know, we are enormous fans of the current version of Coriolis and are just beginning to understand the history and your involvement in making the game come alive and getting it to where it is today. And also, our listeners will recognise that I've started playing and looking to Simbaroom. Again, a game that I'm really enjoying and one that we'll talk a bit about more a bit later on in the interview. But I wanted initially to talk a little bit about your own sort of personal histories in role-playing and how did you sort of get to where you are today in your own sort of personal role-playing.
Should I start?
Yeah,
please. Back in up north in Umeå, in the early 80s, we both have that classic less fair middle class background. Low pressure from parents, lots of spare time. So what are you going to do with it? School is boring. So we tried sports. We tried. Martin's really good at music. I'm not, so I had to try and find something else. So I picked up Dungeons and Dragons with older friends, the English versions. And then there's a Swedish version called Drakar och Demoner, basically being dragons and demons, which is though based on the RuneQuest or the basic role-playing rule set. And I think I might have accidentally dragged you with me, Martin.
I think so, yeah.
So it's your fault.
Yeah, but we knew from before. We met when we were, I think, seven, as we said. I think we played the Dick Turpin fencing with
well,
sticks.
Well, not play. Oh, yeah, play, yeah. Yeah. It was serious.
We were always serious.
He meant it.
We're always serious. Yeah.
I was serious.
That's why I have all these scars, right? He meant it. I was just fooling around with a stick. Anyway, no, and maybe we were aged, I think we're maybe 11, 10, 11, 12 maybe. We started dabbling in role-playing games. Just playing, goofing around, having fun.
Yeah, cool.
And then
they were teenagers, and then it was too uncool to do.
Yeah. So did you carry on playing, but in
well,
secret?
Yeah, it was kind of a thing where everyone quit, but not really.
Yeah.
So it was just sort of, and suddenly you understood that people were actually playing, but like sort of in other groups and so.
Underground,
was, yeah.
Secret.
So it was going on like that for a while, and then everyone came out again as role players.
Yeah,
people didn't care about us anyways.
No, exactly. Why are we doing this? We tried the cool thing for a while, but it didn't work. So then we thought, okay, fuck it, just
let's be uncool again. So we were, and then we, and then some of us started writing. I mean, we not just for the group, but you know. Was a Swedish role-playing game called Kult.
Yes.
It has a resurgence lately with the Kickstarter and everything.
Yeah.
And one who won a group, he started writing and they even got some stuff published.
Well, for what? Was it like that?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah, Andreas, he had he wrote stuff with the Metropolis.
Yeah,
he
wrote for like conventions and stuff.
No,
like
no, no.
That,
he
but,
was also published
oh,
officially.
Okay.
So, but I think he even got paid for it.
Oh yeah! Wow.
Yeah, no. Lots of people have done stuff for role playing games and not got paid for it.
Yeah. I think he actually got paid, even though you know, he's one of those don't quit your day jobs.
Yeah.
But so we've been on it, and then skipping ahead, we tried that stuff, you know, careers and you know having regular jobs, and then we ended up in Denmark, in Copenhagen in 2001, I believe. A fairly wet night. We often said that we should really make a role-playing game. And we said that this night as well. And then we went on having beers and talking fake German, whatever you do. and then we woke up next morning and everybody remembered that we actually said that we're going to make a role-playing game. And
we started during the sort of intoxication talking about
what we should do.
Mutant.
Yeah.
And everyone got really excited. And
yeah.
Because everyone loved that game, and then we started thinking maybe we actually can do this, and we sort of started to. Is it possible for us to do this?
We made the game called the Mutant Undergångens Arvtagare, with the Heirs of Doom, which would be the which is a forerunner to Fria Ligan's Mutant Year Zero.
Is there anything that Fria Ligan's done that You didn't forerun.
Well, they've done a lot of things that we've did before them, but they've done it better. So that's them. They also have a bunch of games.
They took our stuff and just sort of
made it better.
Yeah.
So can I just, because Mutant has actually got, I'm aware of it being quite a big sort of franchise in Sweden.
Yeah.
And we've got different flavors of it. We've got Year Zero and Freeligansett. Yeah. We've got Modiphius are producing what they're calling Mutant Chronicles.
Yeah.
That's a different thing.
Yeah, which is a different thing. But it's had a lot of incarnations in Sweden, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Can you give us, for the sake of our non-Swedish listeners, a potted history of the Mutant franchise?
It started out in I think, 84. With the first one called Mutant, period. It was sort of a Swedish version of Gamma World.
Yeah.
With lots of mutated animals and weird stuff in it. We loved it.
I've still got my old copy of Gamma World on the on the shelf at home. Love that game.
It used the same rule set as Drakar og Demoner, being the so it's
a BRP.
A BRP basically. Exactly. Yeah. And they so that came along and the company that used to own that, called Aventure Spiel, turned into Target Games, turned into Paradox Entertainment, which then split into one part, which is making
Interactive,
which is games, video games, which is where I'm at now, incidentally. And also, but Fredrik Malmberg went to LA and took all the IPs with him.
To become Cabinet.
Yeah, Cabinet, exactly. So he was Paradox Entertainment for a while, and then Cabinet. They have Conan, they have a lot of Robert E. Howard stuff, and Mutant, all the incarnations, including the one
license the Modiphius one, Mutant Chronicles.
Exactly, that also came out. So that's sort of the story of Mutant. And we made a version then in 2001, which we called Heirs of Doom, or the Target.
Right.
And then,
that was, as you said,
the forerunner.
An early version of Year Zero, for want of a better word.
Yeah, so we basically made our version of the first one. It came out in 84.
Yeah.
And then Freeliga made it, again, incrementally better version in Year Zero.
Yeah.
So that's sort of how that came to be.
So did you call yourselves Youngling at that time? Was that the first incarnation of Youngling?
Now it's new Youngling.
Yeah.
Okay. We shuffled who's in it and who's not and all that, so we started over, fresh eyes.
I don't know why we did that, but I guess
let's call it legalities and ignore that board.
Right.
Part.
So we've gone off a little bit. So this was what year had you published that?
2001 was the
2001.
First. 2001. Yeah, and then we ran that. We did.
Did we publish it then, or did we start it? Did we actually?
No. We self-published. We do obviously. So it was
history is kind of fuzzy.
You mostly made cool pictures, Martin.
Oh yeah.
The rest of us,
it's just a blur. The whole.
Now, was that the point when Jan Ringen came into existence? Then was
the
flagship game.
Yes. Then we did some other stuff. We ran as a publisher. We published some books. We did some other small things, and then we realized we needed to branch out and have a second game. Mutant was still then a license from what was then Paradox Entertainment, Cabinet now. So we wanted our own thing, so we started what eventually became Coriolis.
One thing that really struck me in that discussion with Matthias and Martin was the clear parallels between their experience growing up with role-playing games and ours.
Yeah, I think they're a few years younger than us, or maybe a few years younger than me, about exactly the same age as you?
I think they're a little bit younger than us, a few years. Yeah, they certainly look younger than us anyway.
Martin, he looks so young, but obviously isn't.
No, I know. It's shocking, isn't it? Well, I'm so young and I look so old. It's just
yeah,
it's not
you
fair.
Look really old. I'll put it down to the stress of your job, mate.
I put it down to the stress of my podcasting with my co-host, yes.
Right, okay, yeah, I guess so.
Anyway, I was just going to say three things in particular I thought really struck, chimed with me really well. They're sort of starting out in their role-playing experience with Drakar og Demoner and D&D, which, whereas, you know, we all started with D&D back in the day, but then soon moved on to other things and more varied games.
And in a way, I guess so did they, because I think, didn't they mention it was an English version of D&D and Drakkar och Demona is Swedish? And actually,
right.
It's a Swedish translation of RuneQuest. So
yeah.
When I was at school, you were a couple of years younger, but we moved on to RuneQuest quite quickly after trying D&D for a bit. And I think we found ourselves a lot more comfortable with the D100 basic role-playing percentage dice rolls as opposed to D20s. We were a lot more comfortable with that. And I think, it seems to me, so was most of Sweden.
It seems that way, doesn't it? I mean, I didn't really get into RuneQuest so much in those early days. I remember getting the... Oh, I can't remember which edition it was. And not really liking it very much. And it was only when we played that RuneQuest campaign that our friend Andy ran, where I was playing Darthud, the cave troll, that I really got into it and I really, really understood how good the game was. But I thought it was interesting that they then moved on to, in the way that we sort of moved on to Traveller and Call of Cthulhu, they talked a lot about Cult, which I've had a little look at since the interview, and that looks really interesting. I like that it's got such a really good Cthulhu feel.
Yeah, it's almost like Call of Cthulhu from the other side. So rather than generally playing investigators, as one does in Call of Cthulhu, you're playing mystics and cultists, as I understand it. I've never actually played it. It was translated into English a few years ago. And I think more recently as well, another translation came out. But
there was a recent Kickstarter back in 2016, I think, that put out the a new revised version. I don't know whether that was in English or not, but I think you can still play all your usual stereotypes from Call of Cthulhu, such as your police officer, your dilettante, your whatever you want it. But also you can, as you say, look at it from the other end where you're looking at it from the point of view of the cultists themselves, which is, again, really interesting. And then I thought, interesting that Mateus mentioned Gamma World, because, say, I've still got a copy of Gamma World. It's a bit beaten and battered now. Some pages have fallen out. But it's still on my shelf with all my games. And I do remember having some really, really fun games of that back in the day. So that's a real nice sort of nostalgic blast from the past to talk about that.
Yeah, now I never really enjoyed it. I think I only played one scenario of Gamma World and it didn't quite do it for me.
I think the thing that was possibly worked against it was it certainly felt like a sci-fi working of D&D with far fewer rules, which is fine. But back in the day, I think it felt very much like it was just following on in that behind the bandwagon of D&D, I think it felt. But I think one of the other things that I thought was really interesting in the Coriolis part of the interview I had with the guys, which obviously we didn't play, but they've got some really good parallels with Simbaroom. For example, Mateus talked very much about his philosophy wanting games to be about the clash of cultures, and with Simbaroom about being clash of cultures and clash of nature.
Yeah.
But also the theme of space as a desert and sort of loneliness and uncharted and unexplored. Which I think for me is Davikar Forest in Simbaroom, which again, there are mysteries and there are dangers out there. You don't know what they are. It's all unexplored. So that has a very similar philosophical feel for me, I think, as well.
Yeah, I guess it's not as barren as a desert.
No.
But it is very much us or man against nature or against the environment.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Both games share that. But I guess what makes Simbaroom a little bit different from Coriolis is that nature itself is constantly invading. You know, you've got the ruins of this ancient civilization sort of creeping back, growing over, the nature growing back over those ruins. And as he talked about a lot in the section that we're about to listen to, the idea that if you try and bend nature will get back at you in terms of the corruption of magic users.
It's very much a modern theme set in a sort of medieval fantasy setting of if you exploit nature too far, you push it too far, it will rebound and you'll be worse off for it.
Yeah, which reminds me that he inspired me to watch two films again that, actually, to watch one film that I've not seen and to watch again one film that I have seen. Remember how he said that Simba Room was based on the Studio Ghibli film Princess Mononoke. And conversely, Coriolis was inspired quite a lot by Event Horizon, which I think you mentioned a couple of times. We should have to listen to episode 12 to make sure. Now, I'd seen Event Horizon, and I didn't think actually that much of it. So I was kind of intrigued by that, and I thought I ought to watch it again. And since it was available for free on Amazon, I did. And I still don't think much of it, to be honest.
I've never seen it myself.
It's a kind of space horror film. It's a bit like Alien or Aliens, I guess, in terms of its the pattern of its storytelling. But I tell you what really struck me that I couldn't remember at all from having watched it before and now seems so blooming obvious I'm surprised I didn't see it. And that is how the aesthetics of Martin Gripps, Martin Bergstrom, as he was when he illustrated Coriolis, but how Martin's illustrations are obviously inspired by the film. Because the Event Horizon itself is, within the universe of the film, quite a strange-looking ship. Not so much from the outside, but from the inside. Really dark, oppressive bits of machinery. Doors that look like the gates to hell, for reasons that will become apparent. And actually, you know, I'm suddenly seeing that all over the painted illustrations in the Coriolis book. So I can see where those have come from. But one of the things that Mateus said about Princess Mononoke is that is a film about people overexploiting nature and it coming back to bite them. It talks very much as well, that film, I think, about there being nobody, you know, no evil dark lord. This is just sometimes we have to make compromises with ourselves, with our society, with nature itself. And sometimes we have to make decisions that, for all the right reasons, that we know are going to end up with all sorts of consequences that we're then going to have to deal with.
Yeah. And that's the kind of story that are the most compelling and the most fun to either watch or play through a game.
Yeah. So I'm really interested to watch Princess Mononoke, which is a film I know about but have never actually seen, before we next play Simba Room, if I can.
Okay, interesting. Well, we've kind of gone up to the point where Jan Ringen, the first iteration of Jan Ringen, went by the wayside. But obviously, for Simba Room to be out here with us now and have been created, Jan Ringen came back with the new Jan Ringen company. So let's listen now to the part of the interview where Mateus and Martin talk a little bit about that, and then we get straight on into Simba Room.
So, I guess then it comes to now, or not now, but a few years later, Jan Ringen is reborn.
Yep. Yep.
What changed? What made that happen?
And we've been working in like different video games for a while, all of us, us three, and we sort of just spend some time together and sort of start talking about what's fun in life.
Yeah.
And no, basically, I mean, when you work, you have to sort of find some new sort of creativity on the side, and we sort of realized that we actually really liked working with doing RPGs, and we sort of, why not do that again? And that was kind of the starting point for our, and then we started sort of discussing, oh, what's the sort of what is it we actually want to do, and the fantasy role playing game was sort of up there.
Yeah.
We actually never done that, so we sort of said, okay.
We've done post-apocalyptic and sci-fi, but not fantasy.
So it's like, okay, let's, so why not point. Try to do that?
Yeah.
And we actually started thinking about licensing stuff from like the old sort of, I mean, old Swedish licensing brands, but we decided after a while that we wanted to do our own, and we then sort of arrived.
Yeah.
So you talked a lot about the philosophies behind Coriolis.
Yeah.
What were the philosophies behind Simba Room? Apart from being fantasy, what was your take on that fantasy world?
Where it started was if Coriolis was called clashes of culture, this is clash of culture and nature. Sort of how much can a culture use the nature around it without starting to suffer? And we also gave it we imagined three forces as play, one being nature as creative, another force being the disciplinarian sort of that cultivates, and when that goes too far you get entropy, or in our case, then corruption, which eventually will come back and bite you. A lot of the ideas these ideas float around. We just took our own take on it. It's if you've seen the Princess Mononoke.
Yeah, that was a huge inspiration. Yes, for that, the whole.
It's an anime. Where
you know what it is?
Or? My son was very much into.
When you overly exploit nature, it's going to come back, and we wanted to give that coming back a more sort of aggressive, monstrous appearance. Hence the third sort of dark power, the corruption that again created by men or people by not understanding really what they do or being short-sighted rather than. So you can see it as a, if you want to,
sort of a modern message.
If you want to, you could, and that was part of it. And then we built on that from a sort of fantasy standpoint. But that was sort of the beginning of that. So we have a civilized people moving into being basically in sort of an exodus, moving into an area where a lot of barbarians are, and they've been pushed back. And you have sorcerers and dark-minded people on both sides trying to use them to get more of that juicy corruption that they can use. Right? but short-sighted again, because they will eventually lose.
Yeah.
They hope they won't, but...
So, just saying that, I can now suddenly see how and why your art is so different, Martin, for Simbaloon, from what you were doing for Coriolis. In terms of, I'm suddenly aware of how that nature always seems to be overwhelming small figures. Is that what you were aiming for?
Sure.
That's terrible.
Why not? I don't know. I guess. You want to do something that looks very sort of, dramatic. And I mean, you just aim for that atmosphere of that. Sort of the imminent threat or the looming threat or that kind of sort of tension. So,
and there's always a sort of mist floating around that you can't see very far away. So
most of it is just sort of to sort of cover things up. You don't have to paint so much.
But also one thing
it's
smokes and mirrors.
But one thing that we do or that we strive to do that I don't think Fialigan by nature of how the mechanics they have, everything's on the table. There are very few secrets for players in their games.
Right.
Yes. We have a lot of secrets for players because we like the mystery, and I think people come to us for that sense of exploration, meaning you will step into a world and you will learn more about it because there's a lot there. That also has a sort of a threshold for game masters and players alike, in a sense that you need to accept the fact that there's going to be some learning going on. It's not so fast. It's not just out of the box and playing, but there's a longer journey here that you can stay in. That'd be our sales pitch of what we do, right?
Yeah.
So there's a difference between, but also mechanically, you choose your mechanics you want depending on what type of game you want to have, right? Or you should.
Mm.
And if you want it to be like shallow, fast learning out of the box, you get one type of gaming experience. If you have a more of a slow burner, lots of exploration and depth in it, it's going to be a very different one. It's also going to appeal to slightly different game masters and the gamers and players, I guess. So there's one of the differences in how I think we approach.
Yeah,
I love how Jan, how Fialigan does it, but we have a slightly different approach to things depending on I think what we like to play.
Yeah, well, there's certainly a different feel, and I came across Simbaroom when I just caught sight of some of your artwork, probably on the internet somewhere.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, and then what the hell is that? That's brilliant. And there's the artwork's fabulous. And
thank you.
I'm not just doing the fanboy thing here, but it is, absolutely.
It's okay, he likes it.
Yeah. Okay, I will do the fanboy thing. But stunning, and it made me, the artwork was what, because I'd never heard of Simbaroom before. The artwork got me looking into it.
Yeah.
I've now got the game, I've now run it once, we'll be running it more.
Yeah.
And I think, for me, the thing that I really, really like about it, because I started playing D&D again.
Yeah.
The last few months.
Yeah.
Hadn't played D&D since 1990 or something.
We gave up for RuneQuest and Traveller in the
80s. And I played a little bit of D&D at university, which would have been about 89 or 90, but that would have been the last time.
Yeah.
So I was interested to get into it again.
Right.
And I think on my initial read of Simbaroom, it also had some clear parallels and similar feel. But then actually running the game, you could just see how different it was. And just the dice mechanic, the flexibility it gives the GM in terms of, you know, you haven't got loads of skill lists. It's actually in the hands of the GM to come across any situation and say, okay, which attribute applies here, which one would oppose that, and then crack on. It keeps the game really fast-paced.
Glad you say so. That's part of what we're... No, but also putting the old dice rolls in the hands of players. So there are no secret rules. There are no... You know, what happens, happens. The rule dictates.
Yes.
Like the dice said so, right?
Yeah.
So it's more clearly a cooperative game. There's no DM or GM trying to manipulate things behind the scenes. It's like, you need to roll 16 or you're gone.
Yes.
Like, and everybody can see it. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's another interesting element, because the one game we played, I hadn't quite grasped the balance of strength of the characters against some other. We put a couple of ogres up against Matt's character, who's an ogre. Matt probably should have died actually in that game, but first game didn't want to kill his lovely character off straight away.
He's a great character.
So,
ogres are.
Yeah.
But I think it was interesting for me in that the player facing player rolling the dice across the board. And there was one incident in the scenario where the players were observing an NPC being attacked by this evil thing in the dark.
Showing us how bad the nighttime is.
Because my campaign, I just had this idea from... I used to play World of Warcraft.
Yeah.
And in that, you've got a city called Gilneas, if you're familiar with it, which has got this really dark, sort of Victorian vibe about it.
Yeah.
And I wanted to try and get that into my game.
Yeah.
So anyway, it's going outside after dark is a bad thing. But in terms of the mechanics, I found they were rolling the dice for an NPC where another NPC was, and that felt a bit, I don't know, it just felt a bit off for me. So we were debating about whether I should have just narrated what happened and made it up, or whether I would have then rolled the die and then narrated the outcome if I wanted there to be some.
You can go both ways. It depends on what you want to get out of it. But if you see it as a teachable moment, if you want dice in it or not, I mean.
Yeah.
It has some limitations. If you have a lot of characters fighting each other, Stimworm is not the best system you have.
Mm.
We assume it's going to happen rarely. I think we write that the best way is to narrate the coolest outcome rather than have the dice decide it, because it's a cooperative game. It's not meant to be absolutely balanced, and it's not meant to be like where PCs fight each other a lot.
Yeah.
So I guess every system has its own.
And that's an interesting.
Where it comes into play in a good way or is it weaker, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. Perhaps I hadn't really grasped that, you know, maybe actually Simbaroom, from what you're saying there, Mateus, is kind of on that spectrum of just dice rolling, random, this is how it plays out, to completely cooperative narrative games.
Yeah.
Simbaroom is further along that spectrum.
Oh, slightly to the
middle.
Yeah, a step
so
on
actually,
that. So it's a sort of a mix. And I've never been really true to games that I've played. I change stuff that I don't like, and I import things, whatever. And I hope people do the same thing to the games that we make. Right?
Mm.
If somebody doesn't like something, in Simbaroom we try to be more transparent by having like a bunch of optional rules to just show these are the ways that you can simply modify the game without breaking it.
Yes,
and
I like the optional rule where you say the kill version of the optional rule, where you then just die if you lose all your hit points.
Yeah, like in the basic.
Which is bad enough.
Yeah.
Anyway, without that optional rule.
But it's just showing what you can do without.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have to alter the numbers. You can just change what they do.
Change the threshold.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And you can get yourself very different type of games.
Mm.
And I want to encourage people to think like that. So we gave them, I think, 10 or 12 examples of where they could tweak it and get fairly different experiences, right? So
I think one of the things for me with Simbaroom, and also that we're finding with Coriolis as well, is it's actually driving player behaviour to be a bit more careful.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, D&D, you see a monster charge in with your sword drawn.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it doesn't matter if you die, you get resurrected anyway.
Yeah.
I was being careful.
You were being careful. But you'll be really, really careful.
Yeah.
Poor ogre. No, but I guess that's we play with relatively few fights, and really high stakes fights. That's how I think we've always done. But we don't have that. You know, you're gonna win when the fight starts. I think those.
Yeah.
Partly on me as a GM, I think it's boring. So it's like four pieces comes into a room and there are three skeletons there. Everybody's like, okay, this is a 3.5 round fight.
Yeah.
It's boring, right? So yeah. I don't do it. I just, you walk in, I then skip a few rooms ahead, and then you face 16 skeletons and you know, whatever. And they're like, okay, you might die now.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Then we're in a good place to start.
Yes.
Everybody cares that this might go to hell.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the feeling that we want to have.
Yeah.
And it sort of fits the nature is dangerous and corruption is even worse kind of theme that we have in
except for, of course, that friend of yours you were telling us about over lunch, who was the barbarian, and you always just run away and let him die because he always wanted to go and fight.
There's always that, but it could
you
be...
You can always run. It was better
he,
to run.
You can
right?
also say that he was sort of immune to experience. I'd say. He could have learned something from this. But
you were just trying to teach him a lesson.
Yeah,
it was a teachable
moment. I was a really bad teacher. He did not pick up on that.
So, yeah. I think the other thing I was going to talk about is the kind of the dice mechanic.
Yeah.
So... There's been in recent years some really good and some really bad examples of dice pool mechanics in some games.
Yeah.
And having played quite a lot of them, when I came back to D&D with just the 1d20, I don't know whether I was
linear chance.
I was spoiled for it, but it didn't feel like I had enough dice in my hand. And then
you're playing a lot of vampires, or maybe
a long time ago.
Yeah.
Legend of the Five Rings.
Yeah, or Star Wars, the D6 version of Star Wars.
Haven't played the D6 version of Star Wars, but things like Shadowrun back in the day, which I didn't like very much. But I think so. I just wanted to get your take on. You've gone for what is, I guess, quite a traditional 1d20 approach to the mechanics.
Yeah, I wanted to separate the success die and the effect die.
Mm.
And if you have a dice pool, it's usually you do both with one roll, and you roll more dice and get both. I sort of like both. I play both, but I'm more comfortable with. I want players to be able to see on their character sheet what they need to roll to succeed.
Yeah.
And then they get a dice roll that also says this is the effect you have. So it's more of a. I think that the pool might be better in some instances, but it's also more abstract. I think for if you haven't tried it, it's harder to teach.
Yeah.
Because it's harder to calculate the odds. You're gonna roll 9d10s versus a 4 chance of success.
Yeah.
If you have it on a 6, it's a 50-50. But if you do it on a, you know, a variable difficulty, there's gonna be sometimes maybe too much math. But it's not a bad mechanic. A lot of games do it well.
Yeah, I think some games do it well, and I think the problem is the where it's kind of when you've already got a dice pool of 6, 8, 10 dice traps, where do you go?
Yeah,
you know, if you wanna, you know, up the ante a bit, you just add another 5 dice, and you end up needing a bucket to roll all your dice.
Yeah, and it's gonna be what happens in those is that you're gonna come close to the statistical most likely outcome after round 10 or 12.
Yeah.
So when we play Dungeons and Dragons and you're a 15th level wizard throwing 15d8 damage, you can just average it out because who cares? So you get a fixed damage on that spell.
Mm.
Why roll 15 when you know exactly? You know,
the very short range is
it's gonna end up in anyway. It's gonna be, you know.
Yeah.
So that's the thing, and it ended up like that. So if you have, you need to roll 6 or better on a d10. You roll 10 of them. Okay, you have 5 successes by average. So let's roll with that and spare ourselves a lot of rolling. So,
yes,
you know. So it happens, but that's mostly when you have a system that scales up high with number of dice.
Yeah.
So.
What interested me most about what he said there was how he felt the game was slightly designed to be something that took longer to get into than Coriolis. Particularly, you know, he talked about Fria Ligan's version of Coriolis being something you could pick up and play. And Simba Room isn't quite like that. Now, actually, I found, you know, when you said you wanted to play Simba Room, we didn't have time to generate characters altogether, which is what we like to do now. But I'd picked up a cheap copy of the PDF in a bundle or a special offer on DriveThru. So I took that home and I found it really easy to knock up a character really quickly. And not just knock up a character, but to get an understanding of what the game world was about. And I think, I hope that you think that my character Potboy does fit in very well with the game world.
I think your character Potboy and both Tony and Andy's characters, who are both changelings, fit the game world fabulously. And I hate to take issue with anything that Matthias would say about Simbaroom, particularly because it's his game, he's the designer. But I think I disagree with him there when he was saying it's a longer learning experience to get into the game. You know, I disagree with that. I read the rules. It didn't take me long at all to get a feel for them. And but having said that, it was only when I played it that the beauty and the simplicity and the speed, the pace of the game, how all that was facilitated and driven by the rule system. It's only when I played it that I really understood how good it was. So yeah. I read it. It looked fine. It looked okay. It didn't need a long lead-in to work out how to try and run the game. Maybe for somebody who's, you know, very inexperienced, perhaps. But for an experienced referee, I don't think there's an issue there at all. And then, as I said, when I played it, it's only then that I really grasped, well, this mechanic is so straightforward, and it means there isn't any situation out there that I couldn't deal with quickly by a little bit of decisive choosing the right attribute as the key attribute, choosing the right attribute as the opposition, and then coming up with a figure and then saying, right, you need to roll 15 or you need to roll your whatever, -2 or something.
Yeah. And of course, then he confirmed that I was right when it comes to player facing dice rolls.
Well, I think there's an interesting discussion here. He did say, and I agree that I did spot that yes, that situation that we talked about in the first game that I ran, you could have, as a referee, he would have just narrated what came out of that. And I get that. I think that's a perfectly good way of doing it. And as we discussed in the interview, there is that spectrum between letting the dice drive absolutely everything, mm-hmm. and having a game that is a collaborative storytelling game where actually the driving the narrative and choosing what the story is drives the whole game.
Yeah.
And I think there are some GMs, and I think I'm one of them, that sometimes likes not to know what the outcome of a situation is going to be, which is then why it's nice to roll dice for an NPC dealing with an NPC. There isn't always, even for the GM, a clear outcome from any given situation. So I like not knowing in that sense. So in that sense, I think rolling the dice for the NPCs might have been the right thing to do for me as a GM, but then maybe I should have done it rather than making you do it. But I still totally get the idea that if you're driving it for the players, for the narrative impact and all the rest of it, then the GM should just decide how it plays out and then describe that in an exciting way.
So just coming back to your point that he said it was a game that takes longer to get into, that isn't a pick up and play game, and yet we've both described, me as a player, you as a GM, finding it really easy to get into what is actually a very simple rule set to operate and quite a fast one as well.
Yes.
I wonder whether actually he was particularly saying that contrasting the approach of Jarnringen to Freer League or Freer Ligaen. And I'm just wondering whether it's more about a publishing approach than actually the philosophical approach of writing. In that, we got Coriolis, and with that core book, I mean, we got in Kickstarter a few extra things as well. There's other stuff coming out that, you know, we know about and we'll be talking about in future episodes. But actually, that core book has got the whole horizon in it. And you know everything. You know, you can work out everything if you want from that single core book. Now, I get the impression that one of the things he was saying is that the game world will not just expand geographically with each publication that they put out from Jarnringen, but the game itself, the philosophy of the game, and even maybe the mechanics of the game will develop with supplements. So if you like, we are getting quite a brief introduction to the game in that in that first core book, and then as each supplement will build onto that, and that's the way that he's saying it's going to get deeper and will take time to really understand the game.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. And possibly disagree with you. So I think the thing with Coriolis is...
Nothing new
there. Except the agreeing with you part, perhaps.
Well.
In Coriolis, you get all the rules.
Yeah.
Whereas in Simbaroom, the rules are really light. One of the things that kind of surprised me a little bit was that in the core book, there aren't rules for things like ranged combat distances for the ranges. There aren't rules that I found anyway for the ranges of some of your magical abilities, like Tony's Brimstone Cascade thing. Doesn't say how far or how close he's got to be for that. So I made a ruling on the day, which is fine. Some people might be a bit uncomfortable with doing that, but for me, that's absolutely fine. In the advanced player guide, which I'd just like to say I ordered yesterday, it hasn't arrived yet. I do have the PDF, though. They do add a few additional rules that fill that gap around ranges and the like. So I think the difference is, Coriolis, you've got the rule set. I don't get a sense that they're going to expand the rules in that in any future supplements particularly. Whereas in Simbaroom, you've got a foundation, a skeleton of rule set, which is perfectly workable and works really well, but they're adding little bits to it in other supplements. I think also on the setting question, in both games, you get loads of latitude to do your own thing. But in Coriolis, you've got the 36 systems, so that's set. In Simbaroom, you've got Davakar Forest with a few locations pinpointed in it, but the rest of it is effectively blank map. And it was partly that feeling of, oh, there's so many empty spaces here, what's in them? It's partly that feeling that made me create Granite Hold as the focus for the campaign that I'm running with you, Tony and Andy. One thing that Mateus did say, which caught my ear, was that Simbaroom as a game isn't something that plays well for large battles, large combats with lots of protagonists. Yeah, you know, he was being really open and honest and candid with this. But I think it's not the only game that really suffers from that problem. And as you know, I've run the Song of Ice and Fire role-playing game for quite a long time, a long campaign there. We've had quite a lot of large-scale skirmishes or big battles, and I've still never managed... I mean, I've house-ruled it over and over again to try and get a system that feels quick, but also feels it's putting you in the middle of a battle that you, as one of the leaders of the army, can actually influence and change the outcome of the battle itself. So I don't think Simbaroom is in any sense on its own struggling with that problem.
No.
The only game I've played that I've felt has managed it really well has been Pendragon, when Andy has been running our Pendragon campaign since 1985 or whatever it was. The battles for me as a player in that feel really good, and as if you're actually in the mix and as if as a leader you can influence the outcome. But they're also run very quickly, very slick, and gives a real good feel of being in a Dark Ages battle.
Yeah, now I agree. And I guess what Matthias is really saying is that's not the purpose of this game.
No.
Whereas I do think it's a real failing on Song of Ice and Fire, since that is a story that's all about big battles. Yes, it's about the little people as well, but it's often about little people caught in big battles. And, you know, I can't speak to the rules because you're the GM and, you know, I've only done what I'm told and rolled the dice when you tell me to roll the dice. But yeah, given that you've struggled to get a rule set you like that recreates the battles, I think the experience on my side has been fine, but I can understand your struggle.
Good to hear.
That's a failing on that part, whereas I don't think it's a failing on Matthias's part, because this isn't yet, at least, a game about big battles. It is about people wandering through the forest. And I think it's possibly a warning against you as a GM trying to think of a scenario that involves a big battle, because I think, you know, he's saying that you'll probably find it doesn't work so well.
No, I agree. I think my driving philosophy for this campaign is to try and keep it small and intimate and not involving armies clashing all over the place.
Which is exactly what you said, isn't it? You said you wanted this campaign to be about that rather than the Clash of Kings. So that's great. I think that's why we're playing this rule set. The other interesting thing, though, that it dawns on me about player-facing combat is this is also not a game where you stab each other as players. Because what happens if that does happen? I mean, I don't know. You might have something in advance rules. But this is not a game where I am going to sneak up on Tony. Who does the player-facing die roll if that were to happen?
That's a very interesting thing to question to raise. I guess the practical, pragmatic answer is it doesn't really matter. The GM would decide at the time.
Yeah.
I would probably suggest it's the active party. So if you were trying to sneak up on Tony by surprise, Potboy the ogre sneaking up on a very aware changeling.
Well, as you know, Potboy is very quiet.
True. But as the active party, I think you would then be rolling the dice in that situation.
Right, yeah.
I would suggest.
But yeah, I think that's interesting. You know, what is player facing when two players are facing each other?
Yeah.
Let's move on, though. There's just one little bit of the interview to go. And
there is.
That was Matthias talking about, well, Matthias and Martin talking about the future plans of Jarnringen. We didn't learn that much, but it's interesting to listen to.
Yes. I was going to say, actually, trying not to talk about the future plans of Jarnringen. But yes, let's listen to that.
I'm a player, so my experience of Simbaroom is limited, but watching what you're doing, you said earlier on you'd kind of run out of steam on Coriolis. It seems that you're not running out of steam at all on Simbaroom. There are books coming out.
Yeah. The Kickstarter for the Codex at the moment.
What's changed? What's different? How come it's so easy to produce? Well, I say easy. Of course, it's hard work.
I mean, we're in different times in our lives, I guess. I mean, you just sort of... Over the years, we sort of just have this sort of, I don't know, we just want to be creative again, I guess. Yeah. Because we have sort of this, we've been working for a lot, we were working in your, like, in video game, for example, you sort of, a lot of things is that you're told what to do, and you do it as well as you can, and now you actually, and after a while, you sort of want to do something by yourself and be creative, and I think it's just over the years it's just that kind of grew stronger, and now we sort of just try to go with it, basically.
In the case of Coriolis, it was more we ran out of steam as a company and as a group. It wasn't that we had a lack of ideas.
No, exactly.
We gave a quite large number of documents with ideas of what we want to do to Fiamiga, and said if you want to use this, these were our thoughts. We don't care what you do with it. It's just see it as inspirational or whatever. And now we're sort of executing on that in Simbaroom, where we have a fairly good idea, which I don't foresee us running out of cool things to do.
No.
Right now we're doing
running out of time. Too.
Running out of time. Too much at the same time. But right now we're doing a monster codex. We're calling it like sort of a beastry.
Which at the point of broadcasting has got about 5 days left. On the Kickstarter. I think it's next Wednesday on the Kickstarter.
Yeah, it should be. So there we tried to find, and the idea there was to take each monster need to do two things. First off, it needs to be a new type of tactical challenge. And secondly, it also needs to tell something about the world. Right? Otherwise, we're not going to include it.
Yeah.
So just no more monsters, but just more hit points, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah. Need to do something. So we're getting there. So people seem to at least enjoy the idea.
Yeah.
So the Kickstarter is doing well. So that's going to happen.
Yeah, I've backed
which
it.
Cool.
You're good.
Thank you, sir.
In fact, we're running out of time for this interview, I'm thinking. But I did just want to ask, has Kickstarter maybe changed the way you do business enough to make all the rest of the hassle of running a company
worthwhile?
Is that one of the things that's made it easier?
I think it's a big difference between now and before.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't have that before.
Yeah.
And we struggled a lot how to actually... I mean, we had never sort of run a company before, basically, like that. And then we have learned a lot since then. So now it's at least easier. We know the pitfalls in some ways.
Yeah.
And we had sort of how to deal with... the business side of things, I guess. So.
I mean, the biggest risk for any small company is that you grossly overestimate how much people want one of your products, and you end up with having a warehouse full of things people don't want, and you have to pay for that. And with Kickstarter, you get a really good indication of what people want, and they can tell you no early when it's also not so costly for you. So that for that we're thankful. Kickstarter again has its requirements on how you manage it, but if you do it a couple of times, you quickly learn how to do it well and what to avoid and all that to make people not grumpy. So we're getting there, and I think for us it's a hugely beneficial tool, keeping risk down so we can keep going for the long haul. Right, that's good. Pretty good tool.
I think my one last question would be. Beyond Simbaroom, looking a few years ahead, do you have other ideas for other games that you're
that's
working on.
No, this is it.
Yes, there is. There's more.
Anything you'd like to share further, or
can a few hints?
Should we come back to you in a year's
time?
Can
we contact you later and give you a few answers?
If you promise to contact us, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure.
Definitely.
We're looking at that stuff. Right now, we're sort of, our pipeline is full of similar stuff, as it should be. But I think we have other cool ideas that we would like to show people and see if they're interested. But that's... it's a year or two out before we start talking about it.
But look forward to hearing more about all of those ideas.
Cool. Good.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mites. Thank you, Martin.
Thank you.
It's been
welcome.
Fabulous.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, they weren't giving many clues away, were they? I'm really intrigued to know what sort of game they've got in mind.
Well, they did say come back in a year or so, and I think we probably ought to take them up on that offer, even if it was just a throwaway line in the interview.
Yeah. We will. Let's get that exclusive when the Kickstarter's announced, shall we, if we can?
Absolutely.
There wasn't even a clue about genre. We don't know whether it's science fiction or fantasy or modern day or anything.
No.
What would you like to see them produce?
Well, it's funny, having had our little trip and talking about all these games that we've played in the past, I got a real hankering the other day to play Cyberpunk again. So I'd be quite interested to see something set just a little bit in the future, a bit cyberpunky perhaps, because that's a game I really enjoyed playing. I had a lot of fun running that, so yeah, I could go cyberpunk.
Okay, well, given that Coriolis is Event Horizon and that Simba Room is Princess Mononoke, which cyberpunk film do you think they should produce their next game by?
I'd just like to say that Matt hasn't given me any notice about this whatsoever. We don't have a script.
We never run by script. Come on.
What cyberpunk film would I like to see? Oh, I don't know. I'll have to have a think about that one. But setting would you like?
Well, actually, I don't think a successful cyberpunk film has ever been made, but I'll wait for Matthias to say we are doing cyberpunk and it's based on this brilliant film.
I guess it'll probably take something from the original Blade Runner. It'll probably take something from Matrix. It might take something from all those.
I think actually you're right. The original Blade Runner probably is the film to do. I tell you what I'd like to see, and it's not actually from a film at all, but my favourite cyberpunk book, or kind of cyberpunk book, is The Diamond Age from Neal Stephenson. And I think it'd be fun to see that. But we'll have to wait and see.
We will. One last thing I was just going to say. As of recording, we have finished the Simba Room Kickstarter for the Monster Codex, and they've managed to get over $1 million Swedish krona. So they got the roll-up dice bag, the roll-up dice tray, which is excellent news. I should look forward to receiving my one of those in due course. But that's great news, and delighted that that's gone so well.
Excellent. Well, I'm very pleased for you. Obviously, I didn't contribute to this because, you know, you can only back so many Kickstarters. And I'm still paying for Coriolis, which you made me back last time.
Fair enough. I'm still paying for Western that you made me back last time.
Yeah, we made each other back that one, actually. And that'll be another Swedish game to add into the mix. Maybe we can get an interview with Askfagirl when that comes out.
Absolutely. I think we should. The other thing just to say before we sign off is our next episode is going to be some more of the interview with Free League. On Coriolis.
We should say the next episode of the Coriolis Effect will feature more of that interview, but you've got plans as well for Simba Room, haven't you?
I have, because we recorded the first actual play that we ran a few weeks ago, and we've got that not quite ready to go yet, but I'm thinking that if our listeners are interested, then we'll try and put out the actual play of that scenario over the next, I guess, 2 or 3 months, probably, interspersed between normal episodes of the Coriolis Effect. But that will also be 3 episodes of about an hour and a half each.
Well, that's brilliant. Well, I think I'm done here, and I haven't even got a witty sign-off like May the Icons Bless Your Adventures. You know the world of Simba Room more. Have you got a better sign-off?
I could probably think of one. So say goodbye then, Matthew.
Okay. Well, it's goodbye from Matthew, and it's goodbye from Dave.
And may the sun god Prios bless your every waking moment. How does that do?
That sounds good.
For off the top of my head.
You have been listening to The Simba Room Effect, presented by RPGGods.org and FictionSuit.org. The music was the Carvosti theme by Iron Pact Orchestra, used with permission of Young Ringer. Typefaces are Code by Font Fabric and Season of the Witch Black by ImageX.